We talk about wildlife and the ways to enjoy the outdoors pretty much every Wednesday here on the Ideas Network. Today we're going to take a look at fishing from a couple of different angles, or maybe anglers. We could call it that way, too. Without effective fisheries management, there wouldn't be much to fish for. And without good monitoring water quality and contaminants, it'd be hard to know if what you're catching is safe to eat. And we have two great guests with us today who can address both parts of those questions. Justine Haas is the Supervisor of Fisheries Management in the Division of Water of the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. Justine, thanks for joining us today.
You're welcome.
Appreciate it very much. And Candy Schrank is the Fish Contaminant and Toxicology Program Coordinator for the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. And Candy, great to have you with us as well.
Great to be here. Thanks.
Thank you so much for coming by. You may have some questions for them as we move along today. Are you an angler? Do you eat your catch? How much do you worry about contaminants? What's your take on the status of our fisheries program here in the state? Love to hear from you. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org or go to my Facebook page. You can post a question or a comment there at the Larry Mueller Show. Actually, I wish I had posted some of my musky fishing pictures. If you've got a good fish picture you want to post, I would love to see that as well. So post if you got a great outdoor fishing-related picture, post that up on the Facebook page. Well, Justine, let me turn to you first. What's the purpose of our Wisconsin Fisheries Program?
Well, it has lots of purposes, but our motto at the department is that we make fishing better. And basically that encompasses, you know, making sure that there are fish in our lakes, streams, and rivers for people to go out and catch, that the water that they're in is, you know, in good shape, good quality mm-hmm. water, and that the fish that people can catch, they can eat, you know.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Our program tries to, you know, encompass all those things.
What's your background? What's your training in this?
I kind of have a strange background. I'm actually originally from England. Mm-hmm. So I have a bachelor's degree in marine biology mm-hmm. and a master's in marine biology. And then by some strange whirlwind effect, I arrived in Wisconsin, not knowing where Wisconsin was in the United States. I went to Stevens Point, and I have a master's from Stevens Point in freshwater fish management.
So, wonderful.
Lots of education in fish, all kinds of fish.
Well, it's great to have you with us. And Candy, maybe you could talk about a little bit about our program in terms of our lakes. How safe is the water in our lakes?
Well, in terms of fish eating fish, mm-hmm. there's many fish that are that people can eat frequently. We do have a fish contaminant monitoring program where we test fish from lakes and rivers and the Great Lakes, and we look at contaminants. We've been looking at contaminants since the 1970s. So we know a lot about the contamination of our fish. Mm-hmm. So we have advice, but, you know, people can find many waters where fish are safe to eat frequently.
Absolutely. Wally in Manitowoc has a question for you. Hi, Wally. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Hey, I got a question. I see the advisories and PCB levels, you know, warnings on fish. I'm curious, when you test those, do you test just the flesh of the fish, or do you, like, grind the whole fish? Do you include the skin, the bones, the guts, you know, the head in that PCB and testing level, or do you just test the actual parts that we eat, you know, the flesh?
For the advisory, we test the fillet, and that could be like a skin-on or a skin-off fillet, but that's the only data that we use for developing our advisories is the parts that the people eat. You know, for some fish, people like to eat whole fish, but for the most part, we're testing the fillet.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Sounds good. Thanks.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. You can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234. Appreciate your call. What types of fish are most commonly eaten by our Wisconsin anglers? I mean, there are a lot of fish caught. For example, I've fished muskie, and I don't know how many years ago I kept one and ate it, and it was great, tasty, but you would hardly dare to even keep one now. So I don't think many of those are eaten here in the state, but...
Well, most anglers prefer panfish, yep, like bluegill and crappie. You know, those are the fish that people like to eat. But then also walleye, bass, and then trout. And, yeah, muskies are one of the fish that are contain more mercury because they're long-lived. They're a predator-type fish. They eat other fish, so they accumulate higher mercury levels.
And I guess there's just anymore, there's just a feeling among fishermen and fisherwomen that they're something that we should put back in the water, Justine, and instead of...
Yeah, there's a lot of catch and release, you know, especially with those bigger fish, with the muskie. It's, you know, it's kind of almost become a culture for everyone to do that versus actually, you know, taking a muskie home. There's nothing wrong, you know, if it's a legal size to take it home and eat it, but a lot of people, especially with those large fish, like to let them go so they can get to that trophy size that everyone wants to get them at.
Yeah, and I've often wondered, it's interesting to me that bass often will be released as well, but it's rare that I hear anybody releasing walleye.
That's very true. Almost everyone likes a walleye fry, but there's... the bass has kind of become a big catch-and-release proponent in the States. The Bass Federation and things like that have really kind of helped with that. But then that can have effects, too, where you can get overpopulated with the bass because there is no harvest on them in certain waters. It's just all catch and release. So.
Yeah, and well, Mark in Fall Creek actually emailed and wondered about the protection of largemouth bass during spawning periods. Does that harm walleye fishing in Wisconsin because it allows the largemouth bass population to increase?
There's been a lot of concern about that, especially more recently in some of the northern lakes, you know, sort of up in Vilas, Oneida, and the northern counties. There's been a lot of concern. You know, largemouth bass fisheries have been coming a lot stronger in some of what were predominantly walleye fisheries, and the walleye appear to be lower in numbers. We are doing some evaluations and some studies to take a look at that and see if really it is the effect of, you know, more bass, is it the protection of the bass during spawning and those numbers going up that's really reducing the walleye numbers? So right now, you know, is it really happening? You know, it is happening, but is it actually the bass causing it? We don't know the answer, but we are working on that. That's kind of part of our job of the management, is when we see a problem like that, we try to answer that question. And then when we get an answer, then we try and figure out what to do to, you know, make it better.
David in Madison, it's your turn. Thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. How are you doing?
Great. What can we do for you?
Well, I got a question. I was fishing shatek in northern Wisconsin and perch fishing primarily. There's a parasite in the flesh. Is that harmful? Does it die when you cook the fish?
Yeah. And I think the answer to that, Candy, is yes, but go ahead.
Well, what we advise anglers is to, you know, look at your fish and pick a fish that looks healthy. You know, if you're going to take it home and cook it, when you fillet it, you're going to notice some have parasites. You know, if you had your choice, you could try not to eat that area of the fish. But once you cook it, if, you know, if it's a parasite, you can, you know, cook it well, rinse your fish, use good hygiene. But if you cook it, the parasites, you know, just become another source of protein, I guess.
Yeah, I've you see that it's all the time, and especially I see it in bluegills and perch as well. And you know what? We just fry them up and don't think about it anymore.
If you batter the fish, you can't see it.
There you go, Jim in White Potato Lake. Hi, thanks for calling.
Hi there.
What's on your mind?
I have a question for Justine.
Okay.
Justine, this is Jim Peralt, White Potato Lake Sportsman's Club.
Nice to hear you. Haven't heard your voice in a while.
Yes. It was all pleasant working with you those years. Justine, for a couple of years now, the DNR has been tagging walleye fingerling and stocking them in our lake every other year, and they're chemically tagged with OTC, I believe it is. And we were informed that the DNR is not going to be tagging the fish with that chemical anymore. Do you know why?
I think my understanding of this, Jim, is that It was part of a study that we were looking to see whether or not survival rates of the small fingerlings, they're the fish we stock at about 1 to 2 inches, and then the large fingerlings that we stock that are later in the fall, a little bit bigger, probably 5 inches. They were OTC marked, so we could try and figure out whether or not those fish would survive better depending on their size. So it was part of a study that was only over a specific time period, and that time period has ended. And so now they're kind of doing an evaluation of all the data that they collected from that.
And now OTC means what?
Oxytetracycline.
Oxytetracycline. And yeah. Candy, what is that? Do you know what it is?
I believe it's an antibiotic. It's not something that is out in the environment, unless it's released, but it's used for this particular purpose. Mm-hmm. It's incorporated into the fish, and then they can tell how old it is because it creates a ring in the scale.
Yeah, it leaves a mark in the scale or any bony structure of the fish, so then we can take that out and we can look under the microscope to see those marks.
It doesn't bone have a bluish tint to it?
Yep, under a black light, it has like a kind of fluoresces. Yeah, that's right, Jim.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
All right.
Okay. Very good. Nice to talk to you, Justine.
Nice to hear your voice, Jim.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. You can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Post a question, comment there, or if you got a great photo, we'd love to see that too. Maybe you got a good fish picture, put it up. Let's take a look at it. Go to the Larry Mueller Show for that. And Marty in Fox Valley, your turn. Thank you for calling. Hi.
Good morning, Larry. Hi, ladies. I've got a quick question here. And I don't know if this is a little too simplistic for what you're talking about this morning, but I'm thinking with the lower lake levels that they've experienced during the droughts in northern Wisconsin and the increase in temperature the average temperature for the month of July is like 3 or 4 degrees higher than normal. Wouldn't that put some serious feeding pressure on the fish? I have a friend who's a guide up in northern Wisconsin, and he says the fishing has been somewhere in the neighborhood of outstanding this summer, and I'm not sure whether he's just shilling for the chamber, but I would think that would actually hurt the fishing in those northern Wisconsin lakes.
Justine, what do you think?
Well, the way the fish eat is obviously, the body is regulated, their body temperature is regulated by the water temperature, and when the water's warmer, they tend to feed more. So, yeah, if the water temps are warmer, you would expect that those fish are feeding more, so therefore they're probably hitting baits more, so that's why fishing is probably good. On the flip side of that, it means they might be eating more than they normally would for their forage, for those small fish, so they might sort of overeat the amount of forage that's in the lake, so it could have a negative effect that way. So we might see, when we do our surveys in a couple of years, we might see when we start looking at these fish from this year that some, big growth spurts just through this year because of those warm temperatures. On the flip side of that, with the warm temperatures, we can also have decreased oxygen in the lake, which has caused some fish kills, obviously, in the southern part of the lake, southern part of Wisconsin, I should say, with northern pike. So it kind of has the drought, the lower water levels, and the higher water temperatures have really had a different effect across the state on the different fisheries. Mm-hmm. And, it's kind of one of those things where time will tell us what really the impacts were coming up here in 2 or 3 years, as we do our survey work.
Yeah. Thanks, Marty, for calling. Appreciate it. Frank in Green Bay, hi to you.
Hi, good morning. I've been told that there is a blanket ban on fishing in the artificial stormwater surge ponds that are being constructed all over the state on the grounds that these are likely to be contaminated. I'm a bit confused of the logic of that because presumably the water from those ponds ends up eventually in waters that people are fishing in. So why is the blanket ban assumed to apply if it does?
All right. Interesting question.
The thing with the stormwater ponds is that it's an initial, when there's a big rain event, all that water off of the road surfaces or any hard surfaces that the water can't permeate through, goes into those ponds. So it tends to have a high concentration of things like salt because of the salt used in roe during the winters here, and other things. When the water drains out of that pond, it kind of drains into the groundwater and it kind of gets filtered through all the sediments in the soils, which can take out some of that. So as that then leaches out into the other water systems, it's actually reduced the amount of those of the different chemicals that could be in the water. So that's kind of the reason why those storm ponds are normally protected. You know, obviously, one of the other reasons, too, is a lot of the storm ponds are privately owned, and there's obviously, you know, issues with liability on those structures because their sole purpose is to, you know, take storm runoff water.
Hmm. There you go.
Is this just an assumption, or has anybody done any testing to find out if it's actually true?
Well, there's a number of chemicals that could wash off of the landscape into stormwater ponds. Not all of them bioaccumulate. They may be found in fish, you know, if a fish is exposed, but they don't necessarily accumulate to high levels. And we've done some testing of stormwater ponds, but, you know, they're not a typical place where, you know, if you can fish in other locations, that's what we would recommend is that, you know, choose an area where the water is cleaner and safer for raising fish.
Yeah, the stormwater ponds, I would think, too, that from one pond to another, it would be quite a variation. You'd have quite a variation with potentially in what might be in the water.
Yeah, and, you know, they're not stocked by the state, or most right. most of these ponds wouldn't have any fish in anyway naturally because they're basically just built to, you know, take water, and they have water in when it's raining, and then they don't have water in when it's not.
Frank, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. We're talking about Wisconsin fisheries and also eating your catch a little bit today with Justine Haas, who is Supervisor of Fisheries Management in the Division of Water of the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, and Candy Schrank, who is the Fish Contaminant and Toxicology Program Coordinator for the Wisconsin DNR. I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking fish today, talking our Wisconsin fisheries, eating your catch with Justine Haas and Candy Schrank from the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. Great to have them along. Thank you so much for listening in. Please join in if you have a question about our fishery, or maybe about the fish that you catch, can you eat them, or what goes into the fish management program, call us at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org, or go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. You can post a question or a comment or a fish photo there. And Bob just sent a nice picture of some smallmouth bass. We have some bullheads and maybe catfish as well. Oh, there's a great picture of a nice bluegill from a Sunday afternoon with a youngster holding it. Great photos. So take a look on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show if you want to see some good fish pictures, and also post one of your own. Ron in Oshkosh, turning to you now. Hi, Ron.
Hi, Larry. A couple quick ones for you. First, out of the Winnebago system, I've caught a few walleyes with the crooked, curved spines. Wondering if anybody has an idea why that happens. And then the other one is, I've heard mixed reports on going to a slot limit on the Winnebago system. Is that going to produce more bigger fish, or are there some negative aspects to why they don't do that?
Justine, can I?
Okay. For the curved spines, I don't know that I really have an answer. You know, we see that, you know, sometimes with our hatchery fish, we'll see that they kind of have sort of deformities, you know, and it's just a natural thing. So it probably could just be something along those lines of when they were born, or something that they did later in life. They hit a prop on a boat or something like that may have caused a problem. My suggestion is, if you're seeing a lot of these, is you get in touch with Kendall Kempke, who is the fish biologist for Winnebago out of the Oshkosh office. Maybe get some photos and send them to him if it's something you're seeing more frequently. For the second part of your question about the slot limit, I am I've not, you know, heard that they're going to be talking about putting a slot out there. I used to manage the waters for Pete and Well and Castle Rock, which does have a slot protected slot size on the walleye from 20 to 28 inches. And the purpose of that out there was to increase the size structure of those fish, and it actually has done that. So, you know, if that's what they're looking at out there, that would be why they'd be wanting to increase the size structure of those walleye. But I haven't heard whether that's the case or not.
Oh, there you go. Thanks, Ron, for calling. Norman in Wausau, hi to you.
Hi. I have two questions for Candy.
Okay.
One is, you know, we've had PCBs ever since we started measuring them in the King Salmon in Lake Michigan. And my question is, are we gradually depleting the PCBs so that as we go on, are the fish now having less PCBs percentage-wise than they had, let's say, a couple years ago and for sure 10 years ago? And then the second question is, how about rainbows? Because they feed mainly on insects, especially when they're young, and only the big rainbows seem to have the bait fish in them, as do the king salmon.
Good questions. Candy?
Well, yeah, we've seen lower levels of PCBs after, you know, PCBs were banned in the 70s, and throughout the state we've seen declines in the concentrations. And our advisory, you know, reflects those declines. Some of the bigger fish, you know, that are very fatty, like the bigger brown trout and lake trout, you know, they still get up to our recommendations of 6 meals a year or even do not eat. But a lot of the fish are now at the advisory levels are one meal a month. But we do still have PCBs in some of our rivers in the sediments, and those are areas that, you know, are undergoing remediation. And hopefully, as, you know, those areas are cleaned up, the PCB levels will drop even further. For the big lake systems, you know, that's a long-term process, but there's, you know, a number of sources, and so it's going to take a while for even further cleanups, but there definitely are lower levels of PCBs in the fish that you catch.
Mm-hmm. And the rainbows?
Well, what we recommend is 1 meal a week for rainbow trout from Lake Michigan if they're less than 22 inches, and 1 meal a month for rainbow trout greater than 22 inches.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, 1 meal a week is pretty frequently in my opinion.
Yeah, my book too, although Friday night fish.
Do you measure the fillets from the king salmon with the skin on, or do you take that skin off before you measure them? Because supposedly there's quite a bit of PCBs in that lateral line and in the belly fat.
Right. For the Chinook salmon, I mean, we do measure skin on fillet, and what we do recommend is that when people cook the fish, that they remove the fat. You know, the fat that's visible, and then you cook it using a method like grilling or broiling where the fat can drip away, and that'll reduce your PCB intake. For Chinook salmon, we recommend 1 meal a month from, you know, from Lake Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Chuck and Ladysmith, hello. Thank you for calling.
Well, good day. Thank you for taking the call. The answer, I think, was answered in just the previous caller, but it was in reference to testing the fillet. And my question was, when testing, do you do separate tests for just that band of fat that goes along the lateral line, which I think in most cases, you know, is where in the fat stores most of the contaminants are stored? And my question was, if you have done separate studies between just the fat band versus, you know, the meat muscle itself.
Yeah.
Well, we do know that PCBs are the main chemical that accumulates in the fat, but also in the fish flesh that has fat kind of intermingled in the fillet. So for northern lakes, the bigger concern is mercury, and mercury does not tend to go into the fat, but is distributed throughout the fish. So that advice doesn't really help you reduce your mercury intake. It's more directed towards the fish that are highly contaminated with PCBs. And in the northern lakes, the bigger concern is mercury.
Okay, and that's kind of one of the things up here is with walleyes especially, as far as the mercury, occasionally you'll catch walleyes that have bluing, a bluish tint to the fins, and you especially notice it along the white trailing edges where it's really kind of a light blue, and everybody seems to think that that is actually the mercury that's within the fish. I've never heard one way or the other if that's true. Any comment on that?
There's a comment on that, and it's no, I think, isn't it?
Yeah, I don't know of anything. I mean, you know, mercury does associate with proteins, but I don't know if it would be visible. I don't think it would be.
All righty. Well, I appreciate it.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Open lines finally, so you can join in too if you have a question for our guests today from the DNR, Justine Haas and Candy Schrank, talking with them about our fishery, the fish we catch, and also the fish we eat, and can we eat the fish we catch. Certainly you can join in at 1-800-642-1234, email us at talk@wpr.org, or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Lloyd in Three Lakes, it's your turn. Hi, Lloyd.
Hi. My question has to do with, and thanks for taking my call, has to do with the muskie that you were talking about previously.
Yeah.
And my question is, do you ever take muskies out of a lake, let's say trophy size, and now it's 41 inches, and test them, cut them open, and find out just exactly what they're eating, or what type of fish, like either walleye, panfish, like crappies, or sunnies, and if you have you done the levels of mercury and all PCBs on those fish to find out exactly if they're contaminated in my areas in the northern part of the state?
Yeah. Thanks, Lloyd. Justine?
I'll tackle the first part. So, to my knowledge, we haven't done a diet study on muskies. You know, normally that would require where we could catch them, we could pump their stomachs out, or we would have to kill them, obviously, then to see their contents. So for that part of the question, yeah, no, we have not, routinely we would not, be checking to see what they're eating. You know, sometimes there are special studies, graduate projects that do look at diet studies, but I'm not aware of one for muskie right now.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we have tested muskie for mercury and different contaminants depending on where they're from. You know, again, from the northern inland lakes, mercury is the primary concern for fish advisories. And we've tested quite a few muskies, but not a ton. And a lot of the muskies that we've tested are ones that, you know, have ended up caught in our survey nets or are part of another study. And they tend to be the smaller muskies. And we don't have data from... I don't even know what the record is for muskie, but our data is skewed probably towards the smaller muskies. But what we recommend statewide is that women of childbearing age and children not eat muskies, and that, you know, if men are going to keep the muskies, men and older women, that they limit their consumption of muskies to one meal a month. They do accumulate mercury to higher levels because they're longer lived and they eat other fish. And when we do the mercury testing and we get a muskie, we will look at the stomach contents, but I don't recall the exact, what they're finding in the mm-hmm. in the muskies.
And, muskie's going to be around 20 years.
Oh, easily, yeah.
Yeah, easily.
Those big 40-plus inches could be older than 20.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. There you go, Lloyd. Thank you for calling. Appreciate your call. Brian emailed and wondered, can you talk about the contributions to the state fisheries that come from our Wisconsin's tribal nations? Justine?
I'm not, fully versed in, what the agreements are between the different tribal nations and the state. I do know that Lac de Flambeau, for example, has its own hatchery and does raise... a different species there. They raise walleye in the spring, and they also raise a couple trout species. My understanding is those fish go back onto tribal waters, on tribal lands. As to the rest of what they do for, other waters in the ceded territory, I'm not sure. They do survey work, alongside us. They do survey works to make sure that, the fisheries are healthy. And that's on lakes, in the ceded territory area, that northern third of Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm. Randy in Madison, thanks for calling. Hi.
Good morning.
Morning.
Great show. My question is about the Madison Lakes, and in particular about Lake Mendota. Because my thought has always been that Lake Mendota, even though it is in a downtown area, is a fairly big, clean, deep lake. And what I wonder is, what is the recommendation for panfish in particular, and also for small walleyes?
Well,
okay, Candy.
Yep, we do have a statewide advisory that applies to all inland waters, and the Madison Lakes are included in that. The only fish that where the contaminants get a little bit higher and we have to issue more stringent advice is the larger carp. So for panfish, what we recommend is 1 meal a week for women of childbearing age and children, and one meal a week for women of childbearing age and children, and then for men and older women, you can eat more than that. So you asked about panfish. And smaller walleye. So for smaller walleyes, the recommendation would be 1 meal a month for women of childbearing age and children, and then 1 meal a week for men and older women.
There you go.
Is there any comment? Do you have any comment at all on just the cleanliness of Lake Mendota?
Well, based on the contaminant, we're testing for chemicals that bioaccumulate. There's other chemicals that don't bioaccumulate. And nutrients and things like that, but based on the PCBs and mercury, I think you're right in that the water's in pretty good shape.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, it's amazing fisheries, isn't it, Randy?
It's a wonderful lake. The smallmouth fishing on Lake Mendota is equal to anything I've ever had in Canada.
And it's amazing. And I've Bob Cooney, a friend of mine, he may be listening or not. He's a fishing buddy of mine. I can remember going out with him for probably 5 hours of fishing on Lake Mendota and catching 13 species, different species of fish in just an afternoon.
It's a wonderful, it's a grab bag because you never know what you're going to catch. It's absolutely a riot.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. Thanks a lot, Randy. Appreciate it.
You bet.
It's an amazing fishery, place to fish, that's for sure. And it's also probably the most studied lake, inland lake, in the world because of the UW-Madison. I'm pretty sure. It's got that reputation anyway. And I imagine you guys have cooperated with our fisheries people at the UW as well, our hydrology people. Yeah.
Yep, there and at Stevens Point, too. Yeah. I'm from central Wisconsin, so I get to do a lot more with the Point folks. So.
Yeah, but there's a lot going on in Lake Mendota. Dan and Marinette, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi, Larry. I have a question about I'm not sure if you could answer this one or not. It's about the health of the commercial whitefish fishery in Lake Michigan. I've heard from a Michigan DNR agent I know who says that actually the whitefish have been feasting on the gobies that have invaded, and it seems to be creating a good, healthy whitefish population. But one of the local commercial guys says, no, actually the numbers are declining, and the catch is increasing simply because the fish are moving out of the deeper waters and into the shallower waters. So it seems to be creating the illusion of a healthier fishery. And I was just wondering if you had any information on which of these two is correct or if there's some of both going on.
Hmm. Justine, any thoughts on that?
Well, I'm thinking hard. I should have called the biologist up there before I came over here to ask some questions about Lake Michigan, but I didn't do that. I actually used to work out of Marinette and did work with whitefish, but as to that current status, I am not. I'm not sure. I think they are doing some studies. The DNR, Wisconsin DNR, does do surveys for whitefish out in Green Bay. I would suggest that if you to get the Wisconsin DNR information and what we're seeing with the whitefish in that area, to contact Scott Hansen. He's out of the Sturgeon Bay office.
Hmm.
Okay.
Thanks a lot for calling. Well, maybe Scott's listening in. Scott, if you're listening in, give us a call. Let us know.
Answer the question.
Answer that question. Oftentimes that often happens, as a matter of fact. We'll have someone from the DNR call in because they're listening to the show and answer a question. So could happen today, too. An email from Kurt, I think, is an interesting email. And Alex, we'll get to you in just a second here online. But he wonders, how do you warn anglers who make heavy use of fish from our urban lakes? Many are minority and non-English speakers, and the efforts to warn them on the risks associated with fish consumption seem to be not very noticeable. And maybe you're doing more than what appears to Kurt.
Well, the DNR and the Department of Health try to work closely with the county and local health agencies and try to, you know, need to rely on local staff to get some of this information out. We do have some materials and videos in Spanish and Hmong, and, you know, that's been our challenge, but we're trying to, you know, do better at that. And if anybody has any ideas of, you know, what's the best way to reach different populations that tend to communicate differently, you know, we're all
You're all ears.
Yep, yeah. Yep. And one of the studies that Division of Health is doing is an online survey for male anglers over 50. And if you go to our website, you can see find a picture linking to that survey, and the whole focus of that is to try to improve our communication methods. And you know, although that study is focused on older men, because previous studies have found that some older men eat a lot of fish, so that's the focus of that study. But we'll learn something from that, and a number of other studies that are going on by Cornell currently to improve our communication methods.
And Kirk and Wanakee wondered, are the fish consumption recommendations to be strictly observed, or is it acceptable to follow them on average? An example would be, hey, I go for a week of fishing in northern Wisconsin or someplace, and I eat fish every single day. Yeah, well, that's an interesting question, Candy.
Right. I mean, people have to look at what they're eating and, you know, think of, you know, not just what they ate the last week, but their diet, you know, what do they tend to eat over their, you know, lifespan or even just in the last couple of years, and then check our advisory and see if they're eating walleye over and over again from a lake that has higher mercury concentrations in those walleyes. You know, maybe it would be a good idea to vary your diet. Or with PCBs, it's a little different situation because they will stay in your body. Mercury you can eliminate once you reduce your intake of more contaminated fish and start eating cleaner fish. So, you know, you got to look at your own habits and make that decision yourself. But if you just happen to, you know, go out for a week and you're never eating fish another time, then yeah, it's kind of an average thing. But you need to just think about what you're doing and look at the information that's available.
Alex in Madison, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hey, how's it going? I'm a pretty big fan of man fishing. And there's a lot of lakes here in the southern part of the state that have, you know, pretty small bluegills and other fish like that, perch and whatnot. And I was wondering if harvesting them harder and if the lakes had more pressure, if those fish would grow larger, or is that kind of the way that a lake is and it's always going to stay that way?
Okay, Justine, that's something that you guys work on, I'm sure, and Leah think about a lot.
Yeah, we do, and I have a lot of lakes like that, too, where we have a lot of smaller panfish. You know, there's multiple things that could be causing the small panfish, so there's different ways of, you know, handling that. You know, if it's something that's just, you know, they have slow growth, for example, harvesting more is not necessarily going to make any difference because, you know, maybe it's just something is genetic with that population that they're going to grow slower. Or maybe they're growing slower because there's not enough food for them to eat when they have an abundance of small fish. On the flip side, it could be that you have not a lot of predators out there and they could be growing well and growing, you know, as we would be expecting them to grow. But since there's not a lot of predators in the lake, then you get lots of little ones. And then it would be beneficial to take out little ones. But obviously we have to figure out which of the situations it is to figure out whether, you know, taking the smaller fish would actually be advantageous or not to make more bigger fish available.
Sure. Well, Thanks a lot.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Justine Haas and Candy Schrank from the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, our guests today as we talk fisheries and eating your catch here in Wisconsin. I'm Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for listening in here on the Ideas Network as we talk Wisconsin fisheries and eating your catch with Justine Haas and Candy Schrank of the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. You can join in at 1-800-642-1234, email at talk@wpr.org, or go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. In fact, you can post a photo there if you'd like, and if nothing else, go to look at the photos because there are all kinds of photos coming up. Alex has one of a goby, which is, talk a little bit about the goby, Justine.
The goby is an invasive species. It was found in Lake Michigan, probably a decade ago now. It's been a while. And it's a pretty aggressive fish. You know, if you're fishing on, Green Bay or up in Sturgeon Bay or down the coast of Lake Michigan, you can pretty much put a bear hook in and these things will bite onto it. You know, the problem with invasive species is it's a species that's not native and can, cause disruption to our native species. So the goby, you know, it came in and it took off great in the Great Lakes. I don't know of any inland waters that have it. We definitely wouldn't want it in our inland waters because it predates on eggs. One of the things we did find up in Sturgeon Bay was that the gobies they can go in and they can, you know, pretty much eat all the eggs out of a smallmouth bass nest in pretty much no time at all. So, you know, those invasive species can have some pretty negative impacts. I know they can get pretty big now. I remember when I first saw a goby, you know, they were 2 to 3 inches long, but now, you know, you hear about people catching them 7 inches long. So, so they're pretty prevalent in the Lake Michigan, Green Bay, Sturgeon Bay waters, but I've not heard of them inland. We want to keep it that way.
And here's, just while we're at it, a photo from Alex from Tishigan Lake, wondering what that fish is. Now, it looks
like a warmouth.
It doesn't look like, I'm not just, a warmouth, you think?
Yeah, it looks like a warmouth.
Would you find one in Tishigan?
I'm not sure. I mean, they're in Wisconsin waters. It is a panfish.
Yeah, it's not one that I'm familiar with, to be perfectly honest. And there's a gar in here and some smallmouth and largemouth bass. Lots of good, fun pictures. So take a look at our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show, and you'll find bunch of shots there. Dave in Augusta. Hi, Dave.
Well, good morning, Larry. You got a couple great guests there. I really, really enjoy the show. You were talking about the record for muskie. I believe somebody didn't know what it was. The official, unofficial record is 69 pounds, 11 ounces, caught on October 20th, 1947. Out of the Chippewa Flowage. I believe that fish was measured at 63 and a half inches long. It probably was a 30-year-old fish, if everything was true about it. You know, there's a big controversy about what the record is. But I just thought I'd throw that out to your guests. I don't know if they knew that or not.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Dave, for calling. Now, that would be one you'd want on the end of your line.
I think that might pull me in the water, but it'd be a lot of fun.
Oh yeah, it'd be a lot of fun. See, I haven't gotten it. I'm around 50 inches for my biggest one. So
I'm yet to catch one. I try. I always say I'm practicing because I'm just casting and not catching anything.
Thanks, Dave. Jim and Hudson. Hello.
Good morning. I have a question about consumption of rusty crayfish. There seem to be quite a few of those showing up in inland waters in Wisconsin.
And it's been recommended that go ahead and eat them. Candy, what do you think?
Right. I mean, crayfish are invertebrates, so they are feeding, you know, off the low level of the food chain. They may accumulate some metals, but, you know, they're going to be pretty clean. They're short-lived. And, yeah, I mean, there's recommendations that if the rusty crayfish are present, you know, try to catch them and eat them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you want to eat, you know, try to take the crayfish from a clean area and you should be okay.
Okay.
Thanks a lot.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Nick in Center Valley, thank you for calling.
Hey. Thanks for taking my call. I like to make pickled northern, and they got that size limit on it now at 28 inches, and I'd like to pickle them like 21 and down. I was wondering if they'd think about putting a slot limit on those at something like 24 to maybe 32 or something like that, and mm-hmm. that would work out real good.
Okay. Comments?
The way we do our regulations, you know, we tend to try and have what we have statewide regulations, so, you know, they kind of cover most waters. And then, you know, when we do a different regulation, like a slot or something like that, the reasoning behind, you know, changing a regulation is more to, it's for us to actually look at the biology of the fish and what is happening with all the different fish in a particular water body. And then if we think, say, that 28-inch limit was not doing anything, you know, was either keeping the fish too small, we weren't getting enough big northerns to be spawning, then we would maybe want to look at changing it. And so, you know, often, you know, our regulations are normally put on to, one, try and at least allow harvest of the fish, you know, for anglers. And on the other side of that, also allow, you know, the fish to be able to reproduce itself and be able to sustain itself so people can keep fishing, you know, yeah. for decades, you know, and decades. I'm not sure whether nor that we have within the fisheries program, we have a species teams for all the common species. So northern pike has a team. I'm on the walleye team, and we basically, you know, we take a look at the regulations, the statewide ones and some of the individual ones, and, you know, make sure that, you know, they're doing what they're supposed to be doing. So you know, depending on the water you're on, you know, I'm presuming the regulation isn't going to change unless there's probably some biological reason for mm-hmm. it to change versus you know, putting on a slot for people being able to catch smaller fish. That bigger size is so that those fish can get big enough to spawn and keep reproducing themselves.
Yeah. Pickled northern are really good, though, and they're so bony that pickling northern is a great way to go because the pickling dissolves the bones.
That's right. And there are waters, for some reason, I don't have a fishing reg book with me, but, you know, if you look at the individual counties, that, you know, we do have special regulations on some waters. So there are waters around the state that, you know, do have lower size limits on, so that, you know, but obviously not everyone can get to those waters also.
Yeah, true. Thanks, Nick.
You're really good filet, too.
Yeah. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Kathy in Ironwood, Michigan. Hello.
Hi. Do you have maps available indicating the degree to which in a certain area stronger in mercury or PCB?
On our website, we do have a map that shows the whole state, and, you know, most of the waters have similar levels of contaminants, but it does indicate there's about 155 you know, lakes or river stretches that have higher contaminant levels, and those are indicated on the map on our website.
Have that publication, yeah. too.
Right, and we have a publication. I mean, if you are looking for something in particular, you can email me, and I can see what, you know, I'm not exactly sure what kind of a map you're looking for, but we can see what we can do. But that map will show the 155 waters that have higher concentrations of mercury and PCBs.
How often is that updated?
Well, each year what we do, you know, we sample a number of lakes each year, and then we look at that new data for those particular lakes or rivers, and we update the advice. So we try to get back to, you know, the waters with high concentrations. For some of the waters, we go every other year. For other waters, we go one, you know, try to get back every 10 years. It depends on the water body. You know, concentrations are changing, but not that quickly, so we don't need to sample them every year. But we do go back and sample, you know, the sites where we found high concentrations. And we do also sample some waters that have not been previously tested. As you know, Wisconsin has a lot of lakes, a lot of river miles, and we can't necessarily test every single water body, but we do have a pretty good data set, you know, because we have been testing fish for contaminants since the 1970s. So we know a lot about contaminants in fish in Wisconsin.
Uh-huh. And which is the best website to consult?
Well, if you go to the DNR website and you can, type in eat your catch or find advice, and you should be directed right to the Fish Consumption Advisory website.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks very much for calling. I think we actually have something up on our my Facebook page as well. So if you go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page, we've got a link that'll take you right to the information you're looking for. So just go there and we'll help you out. Appreciate that call very much. And certainly appreciate all the calls. Carl and Sean, oh, hi.
Hello.
What's on your mind?
Thanks for taking my call. Walleyes for Tomorrow had a hatchery truck on Shallow Lake this last spring, and they released a million-something fry in the lake. How long does it take those fry to get to be 15 inches? And also, I've been reading a lot of articles on the largemouth bass population being detrimental to the walleye population. I'm doing studies in northern lakes. Is there something to the studies, or what's your opinion on that?
Okay, you know what? We will address those questions, but we're going to have our guest ponder them for a couple of minutes because we're going to take a quick look at the news, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Net, and then we'll be back with Justine Haas and Candy Schrank of the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. They'll be with us right up until 12:30 today here on the Ideas Network. Taking a look at Wisconsin's fisheries today, and also not only the lakes and the fish, but also eating those fish as well. Justine Haas supervises fisheries management in the Division of Water with the Department of Natural Resources. Candy Schrank's the Fish Contaminant and Toxicology Program Coordinator for the DNR. Great to have them along. Thank you for listening in. Appreciate it very much. If you have questions for them, I hope you'll call us at 1-800-642-1234, email at talk@wpr.org, or go to my Facebook page, post a question or a photo right there at the Larry Mueller Show. We have a question about walleye. One question, how long it takes a fry to get to 15 inches? Somebody's wondering that, Justine, and you have any ideas? I'm sure you do.
Oh, we have lots of ideas. No. But Candy and I were talking about, you know, it depends on the water. And I know he mentioned these, he was specifically asking about fry that had been stocked into Shawano Lake. The males and the females do grow differently because the males mature first. So it's probably going to, you know, a 15-inch walleye that is male is probably 4 to 5 years old, whereas a 15-inch female could be 3 to 4 years old.
Okay.
Because she's going to grow faster because she doesn't mature till she's older. She's putting on her length and weight early. So
okay.
So it just kind of depends, you know, and it depends where you are in the state, too. So,
and what keeps coming up as we move along is this whole business about largemouth bass affecting the walleye population on northern lakes. And there's it's not for sure that that's the case, but it's, a lot of people seem to think it definitely is the case, Justine.
Yeah, they do, because, you know, a lot of the places where the walleye population's been going down have largemouth populations that are going up. And so we're trying to determine, you know, is it, you know, the competition between the largemouth and the walleye, or is it some other environmental factors? There's a lot of things that go, you know, play into effect to keep a population going. You know, in these lakes, has the habitat changed in the lake that is now more favorable to a largemouth bass than it is a walleye? They need very different things in their lives to survive, to reproduce. And so, you know, simple things about, you know, What I used to do was people would say, oh, you know, the walleye numbers went down and the bass have gone up. And my number one question is, well, what does the lake shore look like, you know, now to what it looked like 20 years ago? And they're like, oh, there used to be 5 houses on it, and now there's, you know, 45 houses on it. And simple things just by completely changing a shoreline and that shallow water and the substrate in the water could pretty much eliminate walleye because they need a certain size rock to lay their eggs on and for their eggs to survive and produce fry. So that it could be that. So, you know, there's a lot of questions about the bass causing the problem. We are, you know, focusing on answering that question. We have studies going on throughout the state looking to answer that question, whether it is a direct relationship between largemouth bass and walleye or is it more environmental factors.
Yeah, and climate change, you know, could have an. I mean, look at the bass population in the South.
Yep.
And you know, where it's warm, obviously, a much warmer kind of climate, and I think bass are going to thrive. Thrive better in a warmer climate than the walleye will.
Yeah, as we're seeing shifts in, you know, water levels and the temperature of the water, you know, yeah, the bass definitely will be favored over the walleye with those warmer temperatures, especially throughout the summer and during their spawning time periods.
Matt in La Crosse has a question, I think, for Candy. Hi, Matt. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, I have a question about prescription drug levels in the water and if they're building up in fish and what effects they're having on the fish and if there's a safety advisory on that or any studies being done on it.
Yeah, good question.
Well, there are studies being done more at the national level, you know, by EPA and different researchers at universities. And the whole thing is there's a lot of pharmaceuticals that, you know, aren't captured or treated through the wastewater treatment and also personal care products, you know, the variety of chemicals that are used by people when you're dealing with your normal life. And there's been studies on, so far what it seems like is there's not a ton of them that bioaccumulate, but there's other studies that are looking at how those chemicals actually affect the fish behavior and, you know, different kinds of drugs may also affect how fish behave and how successful they are. So what I suggest if you want to learn more about that is to go to EPA's website and enter in a couple of search words about pharmaceuticals and fish and toxicology or contaminants, and you'll find some information on that.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for calling. Appreciate it. Steve in Spring Green. Hi.
Hello, how are you doing today?
Great.
I've got an interest in the last couple of years. There's been a ban on seining or gathering of minnows in the lower Wisconsin up to the first dam, and that's an issue with my family and I. We've lived here for 80 years and seined the lower Wisconsin for bait, you know, bait minnows and used them in the same place we take them. But in the last couple of years, because of this VHS fish disease problem, we're now not allowed to seine minnows, and you know, I think the main issue is transferring minnows to other bodies of water, but we've always seined and used them in the same place we catch them.
Yeah. All right, comment, Justine?
You know, obviously, you know, VHS, you know, did change a lot of the way, you know, how we did business at work, you know, with our gear and moving from water to water. And also it really affected the public in, you know, what they can and cannot do in waters that are labeled as either, you know, they contain VHS like Lake Michigan or waters that are VHS susceptible, which means they adjoin a water that has, you know, VHS positive. So, you know, it is, you know, from a law enforcement standpoint, you know, to make sure it's enforced, you know, a law enforcement officer would not be able to know whether or not you seined that fish there and then you didn't move it away. So to basically protect all the waters of the state and also to, you know, be able to enforce the laws, you know, we had to make laws that made, you know, kind of common sense to the point of, you know, okay, you can not take minnows here, because that way if you have minnows in a bucket there, that you know, if you have a seine with you there and that's a VHS water, you know, we know that's illegal. Mm-hmm. And that, because we can't, you know, everyone has the best intentions not to move the fish, but not everybody does. You know, there might be the one person that goes, well, I can seine here and I know it says I can only use them here, but what's my chance of being caught, and then takes them somewhere else and then we can spread the disease. So it's very much a fact of just, you know, being able to enforce a law and, you know, protecting all the other resources. And, mm-hmm. you know, unfortunately, you know, it makes it a little difficult for some, you know, for our anglers to be able to do what they like to do.
This is something we've done for, like I said, 80 years here. It's a way of life.
Yeah.
You know, we fish all summer, all along, and it's just doesn't seem reasonable if you have property on the river and you park your boat at night and you dump your minnows on, just get new ones the next day, why that would be a big threat. And
I mean, it's, you know, primarily it's because it's, you know, it's almost unenforceable to know, you know, it's a, you know, we couldn't say, okay, people who have land along the lake or along a stream or a river can do this on this water versus if you're coming and going from a boat launch, you can't. It's almost unenforceable. So unfortunately, to be simplistic and enforceable in the law, it makes it inconvenient for you, unfortunately.
Yeah, there you go. Thanks for calling, Steve. Appreciate your call. We have an email from Dave in Horicon. I've been catching perch out of Lake Winnebago. The ones I keep, I put on ice, and when I clean them when I get home, they have a bluish slime on them. I'm just curious what that is from. You guys know what that might be from?
We keep looking at each other, and we're like, I don't know. And, you know, if there is known to be walleye that will get like a blue slime on them, you know, all fish naturally have a slime on them. It's like a protectant of their skin. As to what is making it blue, I don't know. There is a gentleman from UW Whitewater, correct? Candy? And I believe his first name is Wayne, and I can't think of his last name, and he does a lot of stuff on blue walleye slime. So I suggest that maybe that listener could Google blue walleye, and that gentleman will come up, and maybe getting in touch with him, and he might be able to give him a better idea. Either that, or he could also try contacting Kendall Kempke again. I keep sending people to him. He's in Winnebago, so on Winnebago. Maybe he has a better idea of maybe other people seeing something like that for the perch, too. And Kendall's out of the Oshkosh DNR office.
Facebook question from Michael. I'd like to know what is going on with the restocking program on Lake Michigan with salmon. We've heard it has stopped on the Wisconsin side with a four-year lifespan. Could salmon eventually cease to exist in the lake? Justine?
Well, as far as I know, we're still stocking trout and salmon out into the Great Lakes. I did make a list of all the species that we stock as a state. And for the Great Lakes, we stock coho, chinooks, browns, and rainbows, or steelheads, as they're known for the Great Lake waters. And so
the fact is you are stocking.
We are stocking, and there is also, we have a new marking technique that is using, it's like a semi-trailer, and I believe it's Chinook that they're doing this with, where they're putting the fish through this trailer, and they're getting a tag put into their head, and it's an automated system, and they take a photo of the fish, they know how long the fish is, and then we know where those fish were stocked, and then when those fish come back into spawn, we're collecting the heads from them to get those tags out, and we can tell a lot about how old they are, how well they're growing, and that kind of stuff. So my understanding is we are still stocking trout and salmon out into the Lake Michigan.
Steve wonders what guidelines there are for fish consumption from the Mississippi River near La Crosse. Candy, are you familiar?
Well, we have advice for all the different pools in the Mississippi River, from Pool 3 down to Pool 12. You know, those are the parts of the river that are adjacent to Wisconsin. And we do have advice that varies, you know, from one meal a week to one meal a month, depending on the species. And so if the caller wants to go to our website, you know, he can look at the different areas of the river and see what the consumption advice is for the all. You know, there's a Mississippi River has a lot of different species, bluegill, buffalo, channel catfish, you know, all sorts of species. So they're pretty much either one meal a week or one meal a month.
Tom in Walworth County. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, great show. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I actually picked up an extra question while waiting, and I'll take an answer to either one. They involve the same body of water, a southern Wisconsin lake. Got some deep holes in it. Really a good bass lake, a really good northern lake, although northern are pretty quiet this year. The water's so warm. But lots of the fishermen always talk to me about walleye. And historically, the state has put a lot of small fingerling walleye in the lake, and we don't seem to get anything out of that. But every now and then, some big ones find their way in the lake. Once they came from Delavan Lake when it was destocked, etc. And everybody catches them, has a great time. We understand that they probably do not reproduce in this lake, but we have had some experience putting in larger walleyes, like 10 inches. And by golly, those show up the next year and you can catch them. And so what they're asking me is, should we be devoting our attention more to the bigger ones, which might be able to escape the bass and northerns, as opposed to the small fry? And their somewhat related question is, we got a lot of carp, and the hatcheries tell me we should be concentrating on getting the carp out of the lake.
And what, I'm sorry, the lake you're talking about is?
Is Whitewater Lake in Walworth.
Oh, Whitewater Lake, okay. All right. Comments? Justine, start with you.
Sure, yeah. Obviously, you know, if we are stocking a lot of the small fingerlings, you know, we're stocking fish at 1 to 2 inches, there's more bigger mouths that can swallow a 1 to 2 inch walleye versus a 10-inch walleye. So we also see similar things that if we stock larger fingerlings, those bigger fish, that they tend to survive better. Although, you know, we are actually doing some analysis ourselves of our walleye stocking, of our small fingerlings versus our large fingerlings. Obviously, there is a very significant cost difference between producing a fish that's 2 inches long and a fish that's, say, 7 to 10 inches long. We, you know, internally, we've been looking at that also. But, you know, just biologically, those larger fish would do better. So, you know, if it's a private stocking that you guys are doing out there, you know, obviously the bigger the fish you can get, the better, because there's less things that, you know, can predate on it. It sounds like, you know, I'm not familiar with the lake, but it sounds like the makeup of the lake, you know, would allow the walleye to grow, get big, and people could catch them, but they don't really have the right habitats for them to be able to reproduce successfully. And we have a lot of waters like that in the state, you know, that we stock just to produce what we call a recreational fishery, which means it produces, you know, walleye that are big enough for people to catch and take home, but will never be able to sustain itself without stocking. The second part of your question about carp, you know, the one thing about carp is that they really disrupt habitat. You know, they destroy it. They pull up all the aquatic vegetation. They can silt over any rock beds that you have that would be critical for walleye spawning habitat. You know, the carp can definitely, you know, play a huge impact, especially in lakes with walleye, where they might do a little more damage to the habitat that's more sensitive for the walleye to be able to survive.
So, they can be eliminated. Well, actually, you can. You're eliminating from a lake. You're eliminating everything if you're going to poison.
I mean, there's different options for getting rid of carp. You know, it's a very difficult fish to get rid of. You know, once they're in a system, and I'm not sure how large an acreage this lake is, but you know, one of our techniques is we use a chemical called rotenone, and it would kill off the entire lake. It's an exceedingly expensive option, because obviously you pretty much have to start over because everything gets killed. And it's not something we do on a regular basis. But there's other options to have, you know, carp removed out of there. There are some commercial fisheries for carp if the carp are clean enough, you know, if they don't have high contaminant levels. They also have to be the right size for them to be commercially marketable, too. So,
things to think about. Steve in Milwaukee, hello to you.
Hey, guys, ladies, thank you for the show.
Sure.
I got a question. I live on Lake Geneva, and I've talked to the DNR already about this. Actually, there have been a few of us. I've also talked to a couple of the cities on Lake Geneva. Everybody defers to either the DNR or the cities, so I don't get an answer. In the spring and in the early summer, you know, we have the white piers on the lake. It looks beautiful, but a lot of people will be scraping those piers right into the lake, and when they paint them, they'll rinse the brushes and rinse the buckets out in the lake and let that paint drip in the water. I'd like to know, how toxic is that? I quite frankly think there's a legality problem, because that if I dropped a Snickers wrapper in the lake, I'd get a ticket for littering.
That's right.
They're pouring, you know, rinsing the buckets and stuff and scraping the paint in the lake, and that to me is littering also. So what's your take on that?
Sure.
Are you aware of that? And
sure. Candy, you may not have been aware of it.
Well, I've had similar questions, you know, where what I would typically tell, I assume these are like permanent type piers that aren't removed.
No, they are removed.
Oh, they are removed. So, yeah, I mean, what I would suggest is that they be scraped and painted when they're in on land.
We've suggested that. It has gone nowhere.
You know, it's hard to know or prove that something would be toxic. I mean, there's chemicals in paint. There's, dyes and pigments and volatile chemicals, or maybe it's a water-based paint. So, I mean, it's not a good idea to have things put into our waters that don't belong there. There's a solution, I would think, that would be reasonable, but I don't really have a comment on how toxic it would be. I mean, there'd be a lot of dilution.
It's still polluting, though. I mean, it's still polluting, frankly. Correct. You know,
is that the DNR's jurisdiction, or is that each, because there's about five cities on the lake.
You contact the DNR. You'd have to contact the local warden and get an interpretation from the warden there.
The local warden, then? The local warden, you never know. The local warden may be willing to come over and take a look when this is going on, probably in the spring. And if there's somebody who actually calls and says, hey, there's people here doing scraping and dumping paint and so forth in the lake, may be willing to come over and take a look. So it's certainly worth a try.
Yep.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for calling. Meredith from Wisconsin Dells wonder, how does blue-green algae affect the safety of eating fish?
Well, that's another good question. Blue-green algae tends to happen quickly, and when the algae die, they can release toxins that are harmful to people, harmful to pets. And what we don't know a lot about is how those toxins accumulate in fish. There is some evidence that they do, fish can take up the toxins, but they probably don't bioaccumulate to high concentrations. There's still work being done to figure that all out. But because blue-green algae is so ephemeral, you know, it's hard to even sample for it. What we recommend is people go somewhere else. If your bay is having a blue-green algae bloom and you want to go fishing, look at the next bay over, because a lot of times these blooms are kind of local and, you know, they come and go quickly. So we suggest, you know, try to go somewhere else and fish. And if you do fish, you make sure you rinse the fish off with clean water when you're filleting the fish. You know, rinse that fillet again. Make sure you don't get any of the guts, you know, liquids from the inside of the fish on your fillet. And, report if you do have any symptoms. We have our website that describes some of the symptoms that might occur if you're exposed to blue-green algae. But pretty much our motto is, if in doubt, stay out. So I think that applies to fish also.
Would there be less mercury in spring-fed lakes like Chain of Lakes in Waupaca County than in a lake like Winnebago?
The mercury levels in those two particular waters are probably pretty similar. The mercury has to be in a methyl form, and the methylation process occurs everywhere, but it occurs at a higher rate in certain areas that are typical of northern Wisconsin, like, you know, darkly stained waters, waters with lots of wetlands, sulfates present. Mercury does accumulate to higher concentrations in some of those northern lakes, but the rest of the waters are pretty similar. I mean, more it's the size of the fish. A smaller fish is going to have less mercury than an older or larger fish, and panfish have less mercury than a longer-lived game fish.
And with that, we have to conclude. Justine, Candy, thank you both so much. I hope you'll come back and be with us again at some point. Appreciate it very much. Justine Haas is a supervisor of fisheries management with the DNR. Candy Schrank, fish contaminant and toxicology program coordinator for the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. Thanks to them. And be sure to go to our Facebook page. We have a link to the Eat Your Catch page and the fishing page as well, so I hope you'll do that. Coming up tomorrow, Judith talks with our general contractors, John Freiberger and Ken Adams. Thanks for listening. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network.